You're listening to the Growing Leaders Podcast.
Hey, everybody. Let me welcome you to another episode of the Growing Leaders Podcast. I'm Jake Sumner. And we're excited to kick off another episode here today. We've got Tim Elmore in the studio, and we wanted to bring up an important topic to discuss today. This is a topic that Tim has addressed in one of his recent blog posts, and it created quite a response. And so we wanted to dig into it a little bit and have a little bit more of a conversation around it today. The title of that blog post was "A Missing Step in Today's Parenting Path." This is a great title as we sort of dig into this topic, to think about what is that missing step that is not present in a lot of today's parenting. We're going to dig through what we think are some of the six fundamental stages of parenting, but then we really want to camp out on what this last missing step is. If you're a parent listening to this, we hope that this helps you kind of look in the mirror a little bit. Maybe this is a step that you haven't thought about including in your parenting path. And then for those of you that are teachers or coaches or youth workers, maybe this will help you understand sort of the struggle and the journey that parents are on today as they're adjusting to this new parenting paradigm. Tim, do you want to elaborate on that just a little bit?
Yeah, Jake, you've heard me say, in fact, we've bantered this around a little bit around our office recently, that we not only have a new generation of kids on our hands today, I believe we have a new generation of parents.
Yeah.
I think it started about 30 years ago when the shift began to happen, and there was an incredible push on kids' safety and kids' self-esteem, and we didn't want them to take risks. We wanted to protect them, and I think those were all noble ambitions, but I think along the way, there were some unintended consequences. So there is a path that we take. There's a there's a norm, and I want to talk today about how if there's ever a struggle with a child really growing up in a healthy way and becoming the best version of themselves, to becoming a leader, if you will, it's generally when one of two extremes takes place. There is either abandonment or abundance.
Yep.
Now, I recognize those are extremes, but I tend to think if there's a struggle, it means we're slightly leaning toward one or the other. We've not done enough. And the classic there is an at-risk kid that doesn't have a dad or a mom, and he's wandering, and he's been abandoned emotionally, physically. But then the other extreme, which we see just as much, if not more, is abundance. These kids are entitled because we have given them so much. We've done so much for them. We meant well, but what I'd like for the listeners to do on this podcast is we walk through the path for them to be evaluating, do I lean slightly toward abandonment on that or slightly toward abundance?
Yeah, I think that's a great lens to look through, and I definitely can think back in times that I've worked with students. Sometimes you're in a situation where abandonment is the thing that's the predominant trend, and sometimes you're in a place where abundance might be the trend, and other times you find yourself in a place where some students are struggling with one of those and some are struggling with the other, and being able to recognize that's a great lens for teachers, parents, coaches to be able to look through and be able to say, these are the things I need to give to this student at this time and kind of personalize it to that student. Let's jump in with these six stages of parenting. These are more the traditional path that most parents kind of go through. What would be that first stage of parenting you think that most parents kind of jump into?
Well, Jake, to me, it seems like stage one almost always, and I smile as I say this because every parent's going to go, yep, that was me. The first stage is inspecting.
Oh, yeah.
We bring that tiny infant home. You're about to go through this yourself.
Exactly.
And it begins at day one. You start inspecting and examining this new baby and sizing up the features and the traits and the apparent strengths. And, oh, look, he has your daddy's chin or whatever, you know, all that. But we're inspecting.
Oh,
now,
yes.
This is very normal, but too much inspecting can push parents to unwittingly start comparing and competing with other families.
Definitely.
Other children seem to be growing up faster. Oh my gosh, I'm behind the mean here. and we start feeling deficits or advantages in our findings. This can lead to an unhealthy distraction from the goal of simply loving and raising that child in the first 5 years.
Definitely. Yeah, I know for us, we recently went to our first parent-teacher conference with our five-year-old Mavis. And, you know, they pull out the chart and you see you know, not the names of the other students, but you see how everyone compares on this chart. And immediately, as a parent, your first reaction is to go, okay, which areas is she excelling in? Which ones is she falling behind in?
Yeah.
And there's a healthy aspect to that. But I think you're wise in saying, if we get too carried away with that, it can be detrimental.
Yeah.
If we just want to make sure that we're hitting all 100s across the board or getting all A's, it can be detrimental to the development of the child. So,
well, and this probably doesn't need to be said, but in those first 5 years, we are often pushing them to be super kid. We're super mom, super dad. We're, you know, it's a push, push, push. When in reality, psychologists tell us today what they most need is just a caring, loving adult. I mean, unless you're really doing some wrong things in the house, it's that secure base from which you can begin to train them in a later stage.
Definitely. So. Well, let's jump in with stage number two. Once we move past inspecting, what would be that next stage that parents move into?
Well, I call stage two correcting, okay? and really, this is all about our natural bent to remedy any problems that arise in the first year or two.
Oh, yeah.
We see them after year one, two, or three. Oh, my gosh, he's not doing this or she is doing this. So this stage actually doesn't end for years. It may go on for decades, in fact. I talked to teenagers ago. My mom is still harassing me about XYZ or whatever, you know. So out of love and concern for our children, parents can get preoccupied with rectifying all wrongs and improving traits so that their child will experience the advantages he or she deserves. You know, they're off to Yale or Harvard or Boston College or whatever. And moms and dads, really, we just want the best for our kids. So this seems to be a natural thing.
Right.
But here's the downside. The downside is too much correcting can make a young child feel as though they don't measure up to parent standards. There's that quiet, unspoken message of, I'm not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because every interaction I have with mom or dad, they're pushing me to be better and improve. And instead of this being seen as a message of mom really loves me, she's trying to improve me, it's that she's harassing me because I obviously don't measure up.
Right.
And no parent wants to signal their child this message, but I think a child can feel disapproved of, sink into mild cases of depression, and even melancholy withdrawal from other kids.
Yeah. And it's amazing how fine that line is between the two of them. I mean, obviously, you want the best for your child. You want to push them to achieve and to reach their potential.
Yeah.
But being able to undergird it with that foundation of we love you and we appreciate you and you're accepted regardless of how you perform, but still maintaining that balance of calling out the best in them.
Yeah. Now, obviously, there's a balance.
Mm-hmm.
You and I both agree on this. There has to be discipline. So love isn't just fully I'm accepting if you want to, you know, kick a window in or whatever. That's obviously not what we're saying. We're saying there's an environment of grace and love.
Mm-hmm.
But then we're building the disciplines because in this stage, the kid's going to turn 4, 5, 6 years old,
right,
and they will have laid the platform for their character.
Mm-hmm.
So it is important to not over-bias the correcting to the other extreme. Now we're just fully accepting any behavior. There's a balance.
Definitely.
But all this leads to the third stage.
Yeah, definitely. As we get into that third stage, we really look at this as the idea of protecting.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've gone through inspecting, correcting, and now we're at a place where we want to protect that investment that's been made in this child. And so there's this protective instinct.
Yep.
I mean, it's natural. It's a part of the parental instinct that's there. But let's talk about that a little bit. What does that stage look like?
Well, it's natural as well. In fact, sometimes I think we go too far because it is so natural.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it. Parents in this generation grew up looking at milk cartons with the pictures of children on them.
Mm-hmm.
This child's been abducted. And we're thinking, oh, my goodness gracious, I don't want that to happen to my child. You know. And then on top of that, we saw baby on board signs in the back of the minivan starting in the 1980s, as if to say, drive reckless if it's just adults, but if there's a child around, well, we better drive safely. Diaper changing tables in the public restroom signaled these kids are the number one priority. But all of this was screaming, protect your children. Now, that's all fine and well. But Jake, you've heard me say this before. I think we've done a much better job protecting than preparing.
Yeah.
Let me share one quick downside of this. Starting about 30 years ago in America and also in Europe and Australia, we began to take jungle gyms and monkey bars off the public playgrounds. We felt like that was not safe equipment. They might fall down and skin their knee or break an arm, and they might. But what typically happened when you and I were growing up is we did fall down and break an arm, but we wore the cast. 6 weeks later, we go, oh, I can live through that.
Mm-hmm.
And we navigated our first risk. Today, those kids at 9 years old aren't having that experience.
Right.
So they're having, psychologists tell us, phobias at 29 years old.
Wow.
They've never had this risk before. Now I don't want to get married. I don't want to make a commitment. I can't try that job. I don't want to. And they begin to sabotage themselves because they never learned how to how to risk for themselves.
Wow.
Now, I'm not saying be reckless, but I'm saying this overprotection thing can actually be a detriment to our children later on.
Definitely. Yeah, that's amazing to think about how if we don't provide opportunities for age-appropriate risk for students to get a chance to step out there and to risk and to possibly fail and to be able to pick themselves back up from it, we really could be handicapping them for the long term.
There have been mommy bloggers that have written blogs. In fact, one, I'll never forget this, a few years ago, a mom wrote, she lives in New York City, in Manhattan, and she gave her, I think it was her seventh grader, some change to get on the subway and find his way home. Oh my goodness, you would have thought people wrote in and just chewed her up and spit her out because, you know, this child is not safe and, you know, he's going to die and you don't care. And she said, no, it's because I do care. I want him to learn to navigate his way. Of course, I give him money. He's got a cell phone. Again, every one of these parties, both sides, are well-intentioned. My concern is this. If kids don't learn to spend time apart from parents, apart from them dictating exactly what they do, they won't be able to think on their own, I'm afraid.
Sure.
And we're seeing this, aren't we? Working with many adolescents that have never been alone, and now they're completely at a loss for what to do.
Right.
So, bottom line, too much protecting can stunt a child's growth. I believe kids actually need to experience appropriate levels of risk and failure, like you said. In order to mature in a healthy way. And too often, we prepare the path for the child instead of the child for the path.
Definitely. Well, that leads us right into stage number four. And we really want to look at the idea of neglecting being that next stage. So it almost switches from an extreme of protecting to neglecting at the other end of the spectrum.
Here's why I think this happens. And I'm speaking now from experience with two 20-somethings now in my house. They're not in my house, but I've had two 20-somethings. The neglecting phase starts because they're really no longer little children anymore.
Yeah.
They're young men and women. In fact, this stage often starts in the tweener years or the early teen years. And we're at such a loss because the hormones are raging. The child has become, it's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. They're now Mr. Hyde, no longer Dr. Jekyll, who was nice and predictable. And they don't have control.
Right.
That child will, you know, stand up to them and there's this little independent spirit. There's this little rebel living inside of them. And so sometimes neglect is not, I don't care anymore. It's, I don't even know what to do.
Right.
My child is now a different animal. and I almost want to say, go to your room for the next 6 years. I'll see you at 18, you know, or something like that. So to summarize, this child at this stage has entered their tween or even teen years. They begin to feel like aliens around the house. They feel this and parents feel this. And when parents don't quite know what to do with their new kid, quote unquote, they often back off or back down from offering clear leadership.
Right.
They certainly don't want to be uncool.
Yeah.
And they don't want to be unreal. So you've heard me say this too before, Jake. I think we do one or two extremes. We either completely withdraw or we turn into what I call karaoke parents.
Yeah.
Now, you know what karaoke is, okay? We go down to the bar and sing like Barry Manilow back in 1976 or whatever. The karaoke parent's the parent that wants to sound like their child, dress like their child, talk like their child, you know, listen to the same music as their child. They want to be a buddy to their child because they don't want to lose them. But the problem is we become better pals than parents. And the kids actually need a clear compass.
Definitely.
In fact, I think they need secure adults that will be able to say, honestly, I know I'm not going to be liked this week. Bye-bye, children.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that. They're going to love me when they're 30. They're not going to like me this week. But I'm so fine with being their leader because I'm loving them, and I'm going to earn that respect and that love later because I've done the right thing.
So, Tim, as we kind of wrap up the idea of stage four and neglecting, what's really the problem that emerges with this stage?
Well, for me, and this is kind of obvious, but for me it seems like too much neglecting communicates that parents aren't engaged. And really they aren't because they're at a loss. Kids can misunderstand this as both ignorance and apathy. And I often think to myself, it's so funny. It was easy to raise kids when they were young, and now parents hardly recognize them, and this stage now calls for us to shift our leadership style. And that's really my action step for this one. Parents cannot continue to lead the 12-year-old the way they did their 5-year-old. They've got to change styles and really balance that autonomy and responsibility. I'm giving you some freedom, but I'm going to hold you responsible for your behavior.
Definitely. As we finish out stage four, that idea of neglecting, and move into stage five, we see that it shifts to suspecting now. What are some reasons that you think that that transition takes place?
Well, I think parents enter stage five as their kids experience adolescence in its full throttle form, okay? You know, there's fourth gear, and they are, 15, 16, 17 years old. Their child may have pushed to enter adolescence at 8, but now their hormones have caught up with them. Mm-hmm. And so I think moms and dads are starting to get suspicious now, and sometimes rightfully so,
right.
that their kids are hiding something. They're mm-hmm. not telling me what's on Facebook. They're not disclosing where they really were last Friday night.
Right.
And this does happen. It's a very normal thing. In fact, what I want to encourage parents who are listening now in is this. Mm-hmm. It is normal for them to spread their wings. This is a God-given thing for them to become their own adults. Do they lie a little bit and cheat? Probably so. Hope not, but they probably do. They're mm-hmm. finding themselves. So let them spread their wings, but the suspecting stage can be, well, it actually can sabotage the relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, Jake, when somebody suspects you of something, you're going, I don't feel like I'm getting trust here,
right.
and it causes a further rift and further divide.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of suspicion, quite frankly, can breed distrust.
Yeah.
And the distrust may be well-deserved, but communication is key during those teen years. In fact, I would say over-communication. Parents must create safe environments to converse and explore a new stage of relationship. One last caveat, and I want you to give me your feedback as
sure.
a dad yourself. When we hear our children voice something that is completely, in our minds, absurd,
mm-hmm.
they did something we do not approve of. In fact, we think it was wacko.
Yeah.
The worst thing we can do is react, because that tells them, okay, last time I ever share something with you.
Right.
But if we can bite our lips, and inside our alarm bells are going off, but inside we're going, okay, so how did that make you feel? You know, or whatever it is
exactly.
we need to say. We earn the right for them to continue the journey. Mm-hmm. I think they're testing us sometimes by saying, I smoked last night, or whatever it is, you know.
Right.
And what they're needing us to do is lean in and say, ah, I remember when I tried that, but I made a decision not mm-hmm. so good.
Exactly.
But you're a dad of some young kids.
Sure.
What do you see, even at the young ages, where this could happen?
Definitely. I mean, even as, parenting a five-year-old, obviously it's not probably on the same level as the things that you experience when you're parenting teenagers and adolescents. But there's been times where Mavis has come to me and said something about, you know, something that somebody said at school, and immediately there's that part of you that rises up that goes, wait, who said what to you?
Yeah.
But you realize—
Where's my gun?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Where's the baseball bat?
Yeah.
But you realize in that moment that you're going to shut down communication if you overreact. And so it's hard in those moments. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes it may take stepping out of the room and counting to 10 for a second and letting the emotions sort of come down to a place where you can come back and have that conversation and go, okay, let's talk about this. You know, let's find out more details here. And maintaining that two-way line of communication there is so important that sometimes you have to put your emotions to the side to allow that to be able to continue.
Yeah.
And so, a lot of times it's just taking that time out and realizing what's more important in that moment is to really hear what your child's trying to say rather than jumping in and immediately fixing the problem as much as you might want to.
Something I'll never forget Reggie Joyner saying years ago to me, he's just a good friend, and he said, you got to remember the relationship is more important than the rule.
Mm-hmm.
But we love rules, and we want boundaries, and we want, you know, everybody to toe the line.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say, Jake, it's safe to say every parent at some point, goes through the suspecting stage, and we probably do something wrong.
Right.
We say something that's an overreaction. That leads us to the sixth stage, which is resurrecting.
Mm-hmm.
Because something's perhaps gone awry, some category of a relationship with our child has gone awry, now we need to try to resurrect this. Mm-hmm. We try to make it right. You know, we need to take a long drive. We need to take them to Disneyland, whatever we need to do to resurrect this thing. So let me try to define this one, and then we can kind of banter.
Sure.
As a child enters, let's say, their late teens, maybe college years,
mm-hmm.
They're showing signs of wanting to separate from mom and dad and their leadership, and that's mm-hmm. normal. Doesn't mean they don't love parents. It's just a normal thing for them to want to be their own person. Parents start seeking to resurrect the relationship at any cost.
Right.
I want my kids to want to come home, so I will, whatever, buy them alcohol. I'll do whatever it takes.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we do skewed things in the name of, well, we just don't want to lose them.
Right.
We want to stay close. We fear losing touch. And the distancing, as I mentioned, is natural for a youth. The clinging feels natural to the adult, but parents must navigate this stage with great wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
We got to not compromise values or identity just to keep life happy. It may be we go through a little season. I remember with my daughter and my son, there was a little season where we went through a little bit of a, we're distant right now.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like it. I don't think they liked it. And it didn't last long, but for us, it was this, Pam and I both felt like we want to resurrect this. And, yeah. and that's where we had to give ourselves boundaries, where we're willing to resurrect it. We love them, but we're not going to become people we're not, because that sends a wrong signal. In fact, I think this crucial stage, parents probably need friendships and accountability from other parents to just navigate it successfully. Just like teaching them to ride a bike, parents need to blend support and letting go. So I think it's just important to relate to kids in a new way and still act as a mentor during their young adult years.
Yeah. I think the interesting thing about this stage is that idea that there's some finish line.
Yeah.
It's sort of putting that sense of urgency, you know, whether it's getting that driver's license and there's going to be that independence that comes along with that, or graduating from high school possibly and then moving off to college or starting that next phase of life. And I think a lot of times parents can see that finish line coming and it creates that sense of urgency and they do some things in the short term that really sacrifice the long-term relationship that they really do want to establish with their child and help them through that transition.
Yeah.
And so I think it's wise to think about, you know, what are the lines that we're really going to draw? Where are the places that we're not willing to compromise?
Absolutely.
To be able to maintain that relationship
and
walk through that stage.
Jake, you know, I actually spoke to a mother fairly recently who said, "Dr. Tim, I know I'm a helicopter parent. Mm-hmm. I know it's wrong. I know it's not good for the child, but it's what I need right now. I need this." And I thought, wait. Thanks for being honest, but do you realize what you're saying? Your needs are now trumping the needs of your child, that your job is to raise them up to be good adults, to be able to replicate what you have done, you know? And so sometimes I think, Jake, it's our own baggage. It's our own stuff that makes us not so good parents. And we've got to make sure we keep a pulse on, are we healthy so we can replicate healthiness?
Definitely. Yeah, and sometimes it just takes that long, hard look in the mirror to realize it's time to to adjust and change our course a little bit. So with all those, we've gone through the first six stages of what we feel like is kind of the normal progression for parents. Let's really move into what we think is that missing step in the parenting path. What would you say is that one that we need to add in, no matter what stage we are in the journey? This should be something that's just part of every stage along the way.
Absolutely. Well, Jake, I'm hoping all these stages have made sense. There's inspecting their first few years. We inspect our child, then correcting, then protecting, then often neglecting as they enter those tween middle age years, then suspecting, then resurrecting. But to me, when I look at the landscape of parents today, I see many good ones. In fact, the ones listening right now may be brilliant parents who've mastered the art of leading their children. But I find more often than not, the missing piece is expecting. It's another word that fits right into the motif of this one. But by expecting, what I mean is that at each stage of their journey, there should be some expectations that the child is called to rise to.
Right.
Not ruthlessly, not out of, not without love and grace and acceptance and approval and so forth. But I think when I study adolescence 100 years ago, and in my new book, I just began to do this study, I found that children 100 years ago had age-appropriate chores at 4 years old. I mean, they're not taking out the garbage, but at 4 years old, they're doing a four-year-old chore. So there's an expectation. Then at six, then at eight, then at 10, 15, there's an expectation. And I'm fearing that in the name of whatever, safety, self-esteem, protection, we have just removed the expectations. And you have worked with youth before, so I'm going to say something that I know you have something to say back. I think we far under-challenge what these kids are capable of.
Definitely.
We want them to be happy and entertained and not bored.
Exactly.
Last thing we want to be is a boring parent or boring teacher. But I think these kids are capable of more. And we bought into myths that they can't make commitments, they can't really keep, you know, keep their attention on something. That's not true.
Definitely.
They can. We've watched them, in fact.
Oh yeah.
So let me just drill down a little bit deeper, and then I want to hear what you have to say about this. I think part of the under challenge with kids is we've not given them meaningful work. Now let me drill down. They're certainly busy. They are doing stuff. It's not that they're not doing anything, but it's recitals and practices and all kinds of good things. They're not robbing banks. At least I hope they're not. but the meaningful work is, we have not asked them to perhaps, let's just even say, get a job that contributes to the community. I'm actually making this community better by the work that I do.
Right.
I don't think I'm a brilliant example, but my dad coaxed me to get my first job at 12 years old. I threw newspapers on the driveways of houses around our neighborhood. Yeah. And I don't know what I earned, $5 a week or whatever. But my dad taught me about money and stewardship of money. And I had this job. And I'm telling you, 5 a.m. on rainy days, it was still dark. That was not fun. But I built that muscle of responsibility and commitment in me. Then at 16 years old, I could hardly wait to get my first job. Of course, you know, the first job is fast food burgers, you know. And so, but today, I'm telling you what, I don't know about you that are listening to this right now, but for many, fast food restaurants would be way below them. They would never do that. That's too low. And maybe it is. I don't know. But I'm saying meaningful work, the expectation of you're going to contribute is huge.
Yeah.
One last thought, and I want you to volley back.
Sure.
100 years ago, families had kids, lots of kids. It was very typical to have a family of 11 or 12 or 13 kids.
Right.
And you know why? They needed workers. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're on a farm and I need all you guys to be working. Today, having 13 kids would be an economic disaster.
Yeah.
I need 13 iPhones I got to buy, you know, that sort of thing. So kids today, we've done this to them, but very often because of what we've done or failed to do, we produce consumers, not contributors.
Exactly.
They're certainly buying well and surfing websites and getting things online, but meaningful work, I just feel like it sounds so old-fashioned. Mm-hmm. I probably sound like your grandpa right now, but it's a piece that I think could make these kids self-sufficient, interdependent, the way they need to be. Definitely. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I know when I think about this whole idea, the place that I've really seen it played out was at the last place that I worked as a youth minister. And in our youth ministry, we made a specific choice that we didn't want the youth group to be a place where people were going to come and be spectators.
Yeah.
There's a lot of youth groups that do that and do it well.
Yeah.
And there's value in creating that for students. But what we decided is that we wanted people to be participants from day one. And we really set about intentionally developing leaders from within the student group. And it was amazing to see. You know, it would have been completely fine if we had filled a room full of spectators and students had showed up.
Did a good show.
Everyone would have said that was a success.
Yeah.
But what we were able to do is to flip that around and to call out the potential in these students, to find places where they had gifts that needed to be used.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing to see how the lives of these students would light up when they got a chance to actually come and do meaningful work. It wasn't just something that they showed up and watched for an hour, an hour and a half.
Yeah.
They actually had a responsibility. And sometimes there were difficult conversations around those responsibilities. Students don't carry those perfectly all the time.
Yeah.
But the benefits so far outweighed any of the detriments that came from whenever a baton might have gotten dropped.
Yes,
you know, or there was a hard conversation to be had. Yeah. But it was amazing to see how these students, there was a level that was called out of them. And it was obvious in that moment. It was kind of a light bulb moment for me where I went, we should be calling the potential out of students in all the areas, not just whether it's a youth group or whether it's in a classroom.
Yeah.
This idea carries forth in our homes as we lead our kids that are underneath our roof. There's that level of expectation that needs to be called out of them and to give them those opportunities, you know, at age-appropriate places to really be able to have something that they're responsible for.
Totally agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Jake, you know, we have worked together on a brand new Habitudes book, Habitudes for the Journey. It's the first Habitude book we created for students in over
6 years now.
6 years, amazing. So we're very excited about it. It's going to be released in January of 2013. But this book I thought might be great to kind of wrap up our time together by talking maybe about a few of the images. First of all, let me just say, these Habitudes, it's called Habitudes for the Journey. They're for students in transition.
Mm-hmm.
Jake, you know that as kids grow up, there are a lot of transitions. They're on a path just like parents are on a path.
Right.
And so there's a transition from fifth grade to sixth grade, from that elementary school year to the middle school year, and then from middle school to high school to college, and then, I mean, think about it, college to career. Mm-hmm. Backpack to briefcase is a huge jump. So these images are really helpful, I think, for helping these students make great decisions and really respond well to the junctions of their life.
Definitely. So. Well, this first Habitude we wanted to look at is simply called compass or GPS. And I think these are both things that we're familiar with. Maybe a GPS is something we're more familiar with lately because we've all got it on our phones, or we have one that's built into our car, or we have a unit that sticks there on the windshield, and it gets us around town. But we know that a compass is something that can give us direction as well. What would you say is the lesson that we can learn as we think about students that are in transition from these two simple metaphors of the compass or the GPS?
Absolutely. Well, the compasses and GPSs are both about navigation. Mm-hmm. But GPSs, if you stop and think about it, are only helpful when there are roads available.
Yeah.
So in one sense, this is teaching you where to go, what to think. Mm-hmm. But a compass is helpful when there are no roads at all. If I'm up, pardon me, if I'm up in Saskatchewan, Canada, and I'm in a remote place with no roads, just a lot of tall grass, a compass can still tell me where true north is.
Yeah.
And so even when there are no roads, there's no structure provided by a parent, a compass still says, I know exactly how I need to think here. I know where north is. And obviously every parent listening to this would say, I would love for my kids to know exactly how to think, not just what to think.
Right.
When they're given a new scenario and I'm not around, they know how to make great choices. We've got to give our kids compasses and help them develop values that point to true north when I'm not around to help them.
Definitely. That's a great, great thought for us to carry. The next one is simply called A Bridge, Not a Wall. And what would you say is the big takeaway from this one?
Well, this is a great one. This is really about risk. I think each of us encounter new and different people throughout our life.
Mm-hmm.
Kids, it's certainly true too. In fact, this generation of kids is the most multi-ethnic in American history. There are different colors, shapes, and sizes everywhere.
Exactly.
So our natural inclination, Jake, I think, is to see differences and put up a wall.
Mm-hmm.
They're not like me. In fact, I think it's even inborn into us. Tests have been done on 4- and 5-year-olds where they choose to be with kids like them,
mm-hmm.
same skin color, et cetera, et cetera. I think we're prone to distrust in this way.
Mm.
And so that's why I think we need to consciously build bridges that can bear the weight of honest disclosure. All that means is teaching our kids to take calculated risks, not to be reckless, but to take risks, meet people, learn from differences that others have, different perspectives, different ethnic backgrounds. You know, there's a huge word out, tolerance, right now, and I don't know that that's the key, but it's building an openness to learning from people that are different than me, different ages than me.
Mm-hmm.
Along the way, my wife and I would host parties at our house, and actually we would turn the hosting over to our children.
Yeah.
Why? We wanted them to get used to interacting with adults and saying, hi, Mr. Johnson, come on in. Would you like some iced tea? Have you met Mrs. Smith? Can I take your coat? I mean, that sounds so cheesy, but my kids have they're both employed right now because they've been able to interact and build bridges rather than walls.
Definitely. Yeah, I think that's a great perspective to be able to give students and to be able to give our kids before they pass into that next stage of life. The final one that we wanted to take a look at is simply called Tank Half Full or Half Empty. And I think when we read that title, we immediately think of optimism versus pessimism.
Yeah.
But I think there's a deeper layer here. And so let's take a listen as you just kind of dig into this one a little bit more and pull back that other layer as we look at that tank half full or half empty.
Well, it's been said a million times, you know, is the glass half full or half empty? Is the tank half full or half empty? This is a truth about the path that we take.
Yeah.
And I believe the answer to the question, is it half full or half empty, depends on whether we're filling it or emptying it.
Mm.
If it's draining, if my gas is draining from my car, it's half empty and it's on its way down. If I'm filling it, it's half full.
Mm-hmm.
I think in life, we are either building our kids to be contributors or consumers.
Yeah.
And we're building a spirit inside of them that is either, there's a difference, I think, between discontentment and dissatisfaction.
Yeah.
The difference is I should be content with who I am.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't change my talents. If I'm not the next American Idol, I need to be okay with the fact that I'm not American. I don't sing very well. But I should be dissatisfied. So there's a way, I think, to marry contentment, but with a healthy dose of dissatisfaction, in that I want to grow. I want to improve. I want to get even better.
Yeah.
Some of the greatest athletes that we know, Michael Jordan, the great MJ, you know, after practice with the Chicago Bulls, would stay out on the court an extra 30 minutes and shoot free throws.
Yeah.
Probably the one guy that didn't need to practice anymore is practicing more. He was very content in who Michael Jordan was, but very dissatisfied at the same time. Jake, I hear parents all the time talking about, I need to get my kids more ambitious. This is about ambition. This is about saying, I'm okay with who I am, with how God wired me, but I'm also dissatisfied that I want to accomplish more.
Definitely. These are some great thoughts, and hopefully they're helpful handles for the parents and teachers and coaches and youth workers that are listening to this podcast. This is a huge topic, I think, and one that hits home for so many people. And hopefully what we have shared today has been a helpful, few ideas that people can take and apply with their students, with their kids in their home or in their classroom. And so do you have any final thoughts as we close out our podcast for the day?
Well, Jake, when I blogged about this, mm-hmm. I shared a great story that you and I both come to love. Donald Miller, the author, mm-hmm. talked about a friend who came to him one time complaining that his teenage daughter was no longer engaged at the house. Mm-hmm. She was a teenager. And that she started dating this guy that was he was doing both immoral and illegal things with his life. And this dad was just upset mm-hmm. that his daughter was dating this bad guy. Well, instead of Donald Miller saying, gee, I'm sorry about that, he said, sounds like your daughter's found a better story to be a part of than the one you're creating at home.
Wow.
Well, this kind of miffed the dad. I mean, that's not what you wanted to hear. You want empathy, you know? But the more this dad thought about it, he thought, it's true. My house is boring. I mean, I come home from work, slam my briefcase on the floor, turn on ESPN, eat a hot dog, and go to bed. You know what I mean? That was it. As it is with most of our homes, I think. So he began to think, all right, how can I create a better story at the house? How can I do this expectation thing we just talked mm-hmm. about, where I ask more of them and give more to them?
Right.
Well, his story is amazing. On his own, he began to surf some websites, and he found on a website an orphanage located down in Mexico that needed, I think, another wing to be built. They needed mm-hmm. more room for the kids. They needed money. They needed help. And so nonchalantly at dinner one night, he just shared with his family, this dad, mm-hmm. hey, I found this orphanage on a website that kind of needs help. I think I'm going to help them. I think I'm going to send some money, and I think I'm going to, you know, pray for them and so forth.
Sure.
Well, suddenly the family says, oh, really? Where is this? And what's up with this? And mm-hmm. I think within a week, something like that, his boy said, Dad, you know, if we're going to help this orphanage, notice he said, if we're going to help this orphanage, mm-hmm. we need to go down and visit them. And so they arranged a flight down. Some weeks later, his daughter, the one that started dating this bad guy, mm-hmm. said, Dad, I think I could help raise some money on my Facebook page for this orphanage. Suddenly they're engaged. I think it was half a year later. His daughter's talking to this dad, and she says, oh, by the way, Dad, I'm no longer dating that guy. Oh, really? He said, what happened? She goes, I don't even know what I saw in him. Oh. Well, I think I know what happened. I think I see a dad here who created a better story at the house than she was getting anywhere else.
Wow.
And as parents, I think we've got to expect, yes, mm-hmm. inspect, but more expect yeah. the greatest things from our kids. And I think they'll rise to the occasion.
Definitely. Well, I think that's a great example of how we can apply this idea of just expecting more from our students and from our kids. And we hope that you found this helpful as you've listened today. We thank you so much for joining us for another episode of the Growing Leaders Podcast. If this podcast is the first way that you're finding us, we'd love to have you drop by our website at growingleaders.com. Or if you want to dig a little bit deeper into these topics, Tim blogs 5 days a week at growingleaders.com/blog. And we're continuing to dig into what are these topics that can help us lead the next generation well. And so we thank you for joining us for this journey today, and I look forward to joining you for another episode of the Growing Leaders Podcast soon.